Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY 89.1 FM. We'd love to hear from you today during our program. Give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can email us with any questions or comments at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post right on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. Before we get started in today's program, just want to share a quick note in observance of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which is the month of April on WBOY presents tonight. We're going to be airing a special from Indiana Public Broadcasting titled Shadows of Innocence, Sexual Assault Among Indiana's Youth. You may have heard it on our Monday Midday Matters program earlier this week. The special explores why one in five Hoosier women have been sexually assaulted and why Indiana has one of the highest rates of sexual assault among teenage girls in the country, as well as what can be done to stop this violence. That's from 8 to 9 p.m. on WBOY Presents this evening. But for now, this is Health 360 Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. Today's show will cover the mechanisms and management of fibromyalgia with Dr. James Ehlich of the Lutheran Medical Group Rheumatology Section. Welcome, Dr. Ehlich.
Thank you.
Fibromyalgia is a common and chronic disorder affecting anywhere from 5 to 10 million Americans and 2 to 4% of the world's population. Characterized by widespread pain, diffuse tenderness, accompanied by fatigue, cognitive and sleep disturbances, and mood changes. While fibromyalgia was for many years a widely misunderstood condition, considered very difficult to diagnose, intensive research in recent years into the neurobiological basis of the syndrome has brought about a fresh understanding of the underlying causes of fibromyalgia and newer, more effective diagnostic and therapeutic techniques designed to improve the quality of life and alleviate much of the pain of this otherwise very debilitating and distressing condition. Dr. Ehlich is here to bring us up to date on the science, symptoms, and management of fibromyalgia. Dr. Ehlich, how would you define fibromyalgia? Who is affected? Are there underlying genetic factors? What are the neurologic? What is the neurologic basis of the chronic pain? And what are the triggers or causes of this chronic pain syndrome?
As you've highlighted above, it's a pain disorder. Does not appear to cause any damage. It affects, based on spot surveys, about 3 to 4% the female populations when they've looked at United States, Western Europe, Canada, and Australia, and about half to 1% of the male population. It affects all ages, but seems to be most predominant in middle-aged, and can coexist with multiple other types of arthritis and pain conditions. Currently, it is believed to be due to a central dysfunction of the pain system, and that the brain itself is overreacting to the information it gets. And like most complex problems, there's a multitude of things that contribute to that. A recent article by Dr. Dan Claw would suggest that genetics contributes about 50% to this disorder. We have, of course, environmental and trauma triggers. We can often see it coexist with other inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. The nature of it and what we're really trying to diagnose, although the tender points have been helpful, they tend to be less present in males and therefore tends to be underdiagnosed in males. But then the features of fibromyalgia is widespread pain, as you talked about. We define it as roughly pain in all four quadrants of your body. And generally, we're looking for pain in more than one organ system. So often, patients will have a history of migraine headaches, maybe irritable bowel, interstitial cystitis, endometriosis. Those type of chronic pain disorders fit with this. Memory function is often a problem. And upwards of 50-plus percent of patients often have a coexisting mood disorder.
And the one of the hypotheses was that we have a genetic predisposition, but there's some acute triggering factor that sets off suddenly the condition. People can say, I was doing fine, and all of a sudden something happened, and I developed chronic pain. What are some of those triggers that can set this off?
For the bulk of patients, it just occurs idiopathically for no clear reasons. And a small percentage of patients, they may get trauma, particularly that the trunk of the body seems to be more common. There was a study out of Israel pointing that particularly neck injuries were more likely to cause the problem. In the past, it's been attributable to previous viral infections, particularly things like Epstein-Barr, parvovirus, et cetera. But we see similar problems with other arthritis disorders that certain infections or environmental factors seem to trigger off a predisposed condition. We see that in experimental models. So for example, rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, you take these mice who all develop this condition, but if you raise them in a bubble in a germ-free environment, they don't develop the condition. But as soon as they're colonized by normal bacteria, they then develop the condition. So this is not a unique feature to fibromyalgia. This is something that we see in a lot of these complex disorders, just like heart disease and cancer. There are multiple things that contribute to it. It's not just one cause and one effect.
And what is the neurologic difference between patients with fibromyalgia and a regular individual when processing pressure or pain? How does the fibromyalgic patient, the nervous system, handle pressure or pain differently?
Well, what they've been able to do recently with what they call functional MRIs, where you can actually measure ongoing metabolism with the brain. So if you take a normal person and give them externally applied painful stimuli, you can map their threshold for discomfort. And when you do it in fibromyalgia, it takes much less stimulus to cause the brain pain centers to light up on those functional MRIs. So you can actually visualize the difference. What's causing that? Again, it's multifactorial. We've identified contributing enzymes. Dr. Claw's article mentions at least three genetic defects that have been somewhat linked to fibromyalgia type disorders. What those other genetic factors are, we don't really know. Based on how people respond to treatment, clearly serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA, a variety of other neurotransmitters seem to be low and predispose people to that.
So the nerve impulse, someone this pressure, or the way the nerve impulse from the pain sensors are carried up to the brain, there's a difference in the way it's processed in the brain?
That is correct. It appears to be primarily a processing problem. What has always fascinated me, if you were to map pain pathways coming up from the leg through the spinal cord, at about the level of the thalamus, which is your midbrain, pain fibers actually split. Part goes to your cortex, which describes the location and nature of the pain, but it doesn't really tell you what that means to you as an organism. Part of it also then goes off to the emotional center of the brain, the hippocampus and that sort of stuff, and that's where that triggers some of those emotional responses. This is part why I feel that perhaps conditions like depression can cause somatic complaints. Probably most well visualized in post-traumatic stress disorder, where you have basically a high anxiety disorder that creates a lot of physical symptoms, because what is basically anxiety is an inappropriate fear response. So if somebody puts a gun to your head, cocks the hammer, and you get tachycardic and sweaty, that's appropriate. But if you're getting on an elevator, that's inappropriate. But to your body, it's still the same response. So likewise, pain always has an emotional aspect to it. And in this condition particularly, some of the emotional things and physical things kind of borders blur a bit. You know, where does emotional pain begin or end? Where does the physical component begin to end? And the article, even in Dr. Claw's article in osteoarthritis and other conditions, are failing. There's some inflammatory component. There are some mechanical components. And everybody's a little bit different mixture. So there isn't one set kind of answer to that.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. And in the studio, we have Dr. James Elick, who is here to help answer your questions and any comments you might have about fibromyalgia. We're devoting the whole program to it today. So you can give us a call at 260-452-1185, or you can post any questions or comment on our Facebook page. Email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm.
What is the relationship of psychological stress to fibromyalgia? In the past, some of the misconceptions were that it was somewhat of a neurotic syndrome, but it does appear that psychological stress can possibly cause, or as one of the trigger factors, or clearly aggravate aggravate fibromyalgia. What's your feeling? Which comes first, or chicken or the egg, in terms of chronic psychological stress and chronic pain?
Well, as we were talking earlier, a good example would be like a severe anxiety disorder causing physical symptoms. But if you look under the criteria for depression, it has also physical symptoms of that. And even in the commercials you see, for example, with Cymbalta. So it's not unusual to have some element of both. But our most severe patients often have poorly controlled mood disorders or often social stressors. So those contribute to your ability to cope with pain. We also know that those two levels also affect some of those neurotransmitters. Again, some of those neurotransmitters are shared between mood disorders and pain disorders, for serotonin, norepinephrine, and several others. So it's you can see where that they interact at that level. And they may also have a more direct interaction, perhaps at the hippocampus or thalamus level where they're processed.
And we have a lower serotonin in the central nervous system with this disorder.
That is implied by the response to medication. Well, when we treat it with certain medications, just pure serotonin by itself, when they've used just pure serotonin antidepressants, they generally don't affect chronic pain. They have to have both serotonin and norepinephrine to effectively stimulate the inhibitory pathways we're talking about. Because most people are aware of that there are, afferent or what we call pain pathways coming to the brain, but there are also inhibitory pathways coming from the brain down to the spinal cord to help suppress incoming. And in most pain disorders, those are underactive. Now, whether that's a chicken or the egg, we don't really know. But a lot of the medications that we've used to treat a lot of types of chronic pain, everything from headaches, low back pain, and even migraine headaches, have made use of, for example, tricyclic antidepressants, which work on those same pathways. Or the newer antidepressants like Cymbalta, Savella also work on those same pathways.
We have a listener who wrote in with a question, wanted to know, apart from medication, how much can yoga or other forms of alternative exercise help fibromyalgia, help manage the pain or reduce your stress? Is there any studies or data that shows that relaxing exercise like yoga can help treat the condition?
Yes, interesting question, but an interesting way of phrasing yoga as an alternative exercise. But at any rate, there have been numerous studies with exercise. Traditional exercise like a treadmill, evaluations have shown back in the 80s and 90s, clearly helpful. About 3 years ago, there were, in the same year, two double-blinded studies comparing just passive stretching to both yoga and Tai Chi showed clinical benefit.
Okay.
And there's been in terms of lifestyle changes, there's been statements through the years which seem to be borne out that exercise, regular exercise, is very important in controlling this pain condition. And they've shown here that it actually can downregulate the sensation of pain as well?
Well, it's been known for a long time that exercise does help with chronic pain disorders from a variety of type, but it also helps reduce stress, it helps mood. There really isn't any doubt. But the biggest problem we run into with patients with fibromyalgia is even in normal individuals, initially starting exercise is uncomfortable. Your muscles are getting a little injury, they heal, they grow, and this is how you get stronger. Well, with that exaggerated pain response, they often can't get themselves to do it because it just hurts too much. So initially, rest will feel better, but now your muscles are more deconditioned and it takes less activity to cause that pain threshold. So at some point, they have to bite the bullet and work through some of that discomfort to get better. And so exercise clearly is a key role, as well as managing their stress. And particularly, that's one of the more rewarding things when I see patients, when they start connecting the dots and they notice the stress and the exercise clearly helping, they're on the road to helping themselves. Because medications themselves will only get you so far. At some point, because the drugs aren't as good as we'd like, the patients have to take over at some point.
And it's been stressed that this should be low-impact exercise rather than high-impact exercise. On the same level, in terms of lifestyle changes, it's been recommended in patients with fibromyalgia to really exercise regularly. Sleep seems to be an extremely important factor with fibromyalgia. And that sleeping regularly is also another one of these lifestyle changes that fibromyalgia patients should be using. But there is a neurobiological aspect of sleep that is affected by fibromyalgia. What is that?
Well, initially when fibromyalgia first getting coined as a term back in the 70s, Smith, who is a psychiatrist out of Toronto, had an interest in sleep labs. And what they noticed at that time is if you took normal sedentary people, and of course they had already mapped out fibromyalgia patients, and they had abnormal deep non-REM sleep. So stage 3-4 was abnormal in these patients. And they, if they interrupted normal individuals, sedentary individuals, they would start getting achiness similar to they saw in fibromyalgia, but not in well-conditioned athletes. So then they just tried looking at sleep as an etiology. And what they found over the years is sleep abnormalities were very common, similar to what we saw in fibromyalgia, both in patients with mood disorders and other types of chronic pain. So it appeared to be more the chicken rather than the egg sort of phenomenon. So although sleep was important, it was more of a secondary event to the other things going on rather than the primary event. That, of course, then led to other areas of research, which we had talked about earlier. Mm-hmm.
And with the EEG studies, they showed that this deep sleep period, the non-REM deep sleep period, there's actually awakenings and arousals during that time that prevent the deep sleep. And it's during the deep sleep that we do have some of the reparative functions, and growth hormone plays a role here too.
That is correct.
And there's less growth hormone. Apparently, you need the deep sleep to have growth hormone. Growth hormone has reparative effects on the muscles, so we get into a downward spiral.
Well, restful sleep is very important. I think it's interesting because I was at a lecture several years ago, and one of the sleep experts said, we know that all animals have to sleep, but we really can't tell you why you need to sleep. I mean, we clearly need that to regenerate, but we really don't understand why.
Mm-hmm.
But some of that growth process, that's where you grow. That's where your muscles heal. So a lot of stuff occurs when you're in that phase of sleep, and when you get interrupted, for example, they find this is a huge problem with sleep shift workers. You know, they never get to a normal sleep because often they come home from their night shift, they have to go do stuff with the kids, do other stuff, and they never do get the restful sleep. And it's been linked to obesity because you eat more because you're tired and you're more depressed because you're not getting the rest. So good sleep is important for general health, but in particularly chronic pain, it's sometimes difficult to do. Patients with severe pain often what we do is call reverse disorder. They can't sleep at night, so that they're so tired that they wind up sleeping during the day. They actually flip their cycle around, and it does take a lot of effort to try and get that back on track.
And I'm sure that perpetuates more stress on the body, but both physically on the body and mentally, the stress, which probably can't help if you're suffering from fibromyalgia. We have a question from James, who wrote in. How do you know if you have fibromyalgia or a different type of arthritis?
Well, the best way is probably to see your doctor or rheumatologist to get a more complete evaluation. The tip off that it may be fibromyalgia is what we look at, widespread pain and pain in more than one organ system. As far as other types of pain, generally the arthritis complaints are more specified to the joints, and you may have things like swelling or rashes. Your lab work may be abnormal. And of course, then if you're dealing with an inflammatory disorder, treating the inflammation is usually much more helpful than just non-specifically treating the pain.
But that with the diagnosis of fibromyalgia is usually by exclusion. You really have to rule out these other conditions, and that's made it difficult through the years to pin down the fibromyalgia diagnosis itself.
We do a lot to exclude other diagnoses. Frequently, the primary care doctors will order what we call anti-nuclear antibodies, or ANAs, and they have a very high rate of false positivity. And other specialties, other rheumatology, are not particularly comfortable with saying it is lupus or not. But rheumatology, of course, just because we see so many patients with that, often have some abnormal blood work. It may not be part of the pain. So what we're looking more is for a pattern. So often you get patients say, you know, I hurt all over. I can't sleep at night. I can't, my memories, I have no energy. I have abdominal bloating, cramping. It's pretty easy to see that pattern. You'll confirm it by the tender points. But almost as importantly is you want to see that the other blood work relatively normal. They don't have swollen joints abnormal rashes that might explain specific stuff. So if you come in with just a swollen knee and a wrist, that's not fibromyalgia.
And the fibromyalgia diagnosis basically involves making sure there's no other causes of pain, and then you can zero in on the pain of fibromyalgia itself. So rule out other diseases that might be causing it.
That is correct. But a significant portion of our patients often have coexisting fibromyalgia with their inflammatory disorder, which is quite a challenge for us as rheumatologists. So how much of this person's pain is coming from inflammatory sources versus non-inflammatory, because they're treated very differently. Mm-hmm. So we see it in our rheumatoid arthritis patients. There have been at least two articles looking at dysfunction as far as a functional status in patients with lupus are often more inhibited by their coexisting fibromyalgia than they are from their lupus per se. So it can and frequently does coexist with these disorders. And for the rheumatologist, it can sometimes be quite a challenge to, what do we adjust at this visit? Are we going to adjust your fibromyalgia medicines, or are we going to adjust your rheumatoid arthritis medications?
This is Health 360 Midday Matters on WBOI 89.1 FM, and we are discussing fibromyalgia this hour of the program, and we have Dr. James Ehlich to help answer any questions or comments that you may have. 260-452-1185 is the number to call, or you can post on our Facebook page or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more of Health 360 in just a few moments.
After years of dealing with his son's addiction, which he wrote about in his bestseller, Beautiful Boy, David Sheff has written a new book called Clean, about the latest research into addiction and recovery. On the next Fresh Air, Sheff challenges some myths about addiction and recovery and talks about his own experiences as a parent. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by United Way of Allen County, helping kids succeed in school with 15 education network partners, offering ways to mentor or tutor a child. UWEducationNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Health 360. It's 12:30 and you're tuned to 89.1 FM WBOI Fort Wayne. In the studio, we have Dr. James Ehlich, who is helping answer any questions or comments you have about fibromyalgia during today's program. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and in the studio, I also have my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman. If you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We do have a listener on line one. June, welcome to Health 360.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. Do you have any suggestions for the brain fog or the memory issues that tend to go along with fibromyalgia? Do you have any tips that can help us what to do about that?
Well, we see the same memory issues in depression and other mood disorders as well as fibromyalgia. when they've done formal, you know, extensive psychological testing, it's not truly a memory problem, but more of a focus issue. And that is felt to be more sensitive to norepinephrine. It's one of those molecules that we use also in treating fibromyalgia. So often when that's a problem, I tend to focus more on medications that are a little heavier with the norepinephrine component than the serotonin component.
We have Charles on line two. Charles, welcome to Health 360.
Well, thank you very much. Question for the doctor is, you know, I'm a 53-year-old man, and I've suffered a few traumas from, like, motorcycle accidents to like, I was involved in a car accident here a while back that really hurt my neck. And then I noticed that when my neck's really bothering me, and because I just haven't been able to do any therapy. I'm a truck driver, so I'm not at home a lot and all. So, but I noticed that, like, different kind of noises and all that can really just set me off, and I've got to bite my tongue sometimes. But I kind of like this program because it kind of makes me wonder a little bit with the other traumas that I've received and the arthritis that I do have from the traumas and stuff like that. And is this something I should check more into that I could be highly susceptible for? I mean, I know there's other folks out there that have suffered the traumatic injuries like I have. Is this something we need to be on the lookout for?
Well, a number of people who have injuries can sometimes be brought out to have chronic pain. Again, we come back to that genetic predisposition. You know, if for example, you were to eat a cheeseburger and get a heart attack, which has been known to happen, but obviously the underlying coronary arteries weren't normal to begin with. So we see the same thing, for example, with mechanical low back pain. Somebody bends over, hurts their back, and maybe 1% of the population never fully gets better. That clearly wasn't related necessarily to that trauma, because at some point they were probably going to get that. But multiple traumas obviously can help bring out chronic pain. But these pain conditions are multifactorial, so it's more than just the trauma. And the other thing is, if noises are making you that irritable, wonder if the pain is bringing out maybe a little low-grade depression to boot and making you more irritable. Those things could be, and of course we have some medicines that would help both those conditions now.
Do you have chronic pain?
My neck bothers me quite a bit since the accident, and it's been over a year, and it just hasn't gone away. And then from where I'm wired, my sternum's been wired back together. My right hand was basically destroyed and rebuilt, which I still have. And, you know, it's like I can detect weather changes on a real regular basis. But it's my neck that's been bothering me the most. And part of the lead up to the questions and all that was about the spinal injuries and neck pains and all that. And that's, you know, I'm a grouchy old man to begin with, according to my kids, but this is one of those things that kind of makes me think about, is this something that I'm possibly should be looking out for and be more aware of? That was my main question with the traumatic injuries that I've received over the years of leading a rough life. In other words, being the horse that's been rode hard, put up wet more than once.
Well, the nice thing about this condition, if there is it doesn't really cause any damage. So if you can deal with the symptoms and the people around you can deal with the symptoms, almost as importantly, then there's no harm in not treating it if you recognize the condition.
Mm-hmm. So no harm in getting yourself checked out and seeking a medical professional's opinion, probably best in an actual doctor's office. 260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question. And thanks so much to June and Charles for calling in and asking your questions.
Our caller brought up another interesting point that apparently it's been shown that it's not just contact or touching painful stimuli, but loud noises or strong odors or changes in temperature. Apparently, these patients have a hyperreactivity to any noxious stimuli. Is this true?
Well, temperature, of course, has been noted with a variety of arthritis disorders and pain disorders. So when the pain system's hypersensitive, you do notice those barometric pains. But we see that in osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, as well as fibromyalgia. smells, loud noises. You see that with head migraine patients often. We used to see it in a condition called chronic fatigue syndrome. That was more commonly published with that. But we do see it with fibromyalgia. But more commonly, I say more in my migraine patients than.
But you mentioned earlier that patients with fibromyalgia often have these conditions that you just mentioned,
right,
as comorbid conditions that go along with it.
We had a listener write in who says, my 16-year-old daughter has been diagnosed with fibromyalgia. Does the doctor in the studio treat teens? And can you discuss a little bit more about how teens are affected differently by fibromyalgia, or are there similarities to an adult who is diagnosed later in life?
Well, no longer treating teenage fibromyalgia, but it is treated basically the same way. But considering the younger age of onset, I think we worry a little bit more about some underlying mood disorders or previous trauma. They've done lots of studies showing that patients with chronic pain disorders have much higher rates of previous abuse, both physical and sexual. It's certainly not in everybody, but that's often one of the things in the back of mind when we see very young patients with pain disorders. And it may get down to some of that mood disorders, because we often patients with mood disorders, some of them will start presenting in their teenage years. Most typically it's middle age, but some will present in their teenage years.
What is the relationship between fibromyalgia and menopause? Some of the articles mentioned that many of the younger women that develop fibromyalgia had early menopause or changes in their female hormone system. Where do you stand on the relationship between fibromyalgia and female hormonal status?
I haven't read anything that's been consistent with that observation. I think age-wise, it's often coming down in women who are in their perimenopause period of time. But certainly I see a substantial number of patients in their 20s and 30s who are not anywhere near who have fibromyalgia, as we talked about, even teenagers. The symptoms tend to be worse during the luteal phase of the cycle because the progesterone lowers your central nervous system serotonin, so you will see more mood disorders, stress, headaches, that sort of stuff. But I'm not aware of any real substantial link between menopause and fibromyalgia.
But these patients will have more severe menstrual pain.
Correct.
In and around the period.
We need to take a short break for the news here on Health 360, but we'll be back in the meantime. If you have any questions or comments, 260-452-1185 is the number to call, or you can post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Tech companies are leading the push for more temporary visas for skilled foreign workers, but the biggest users of those visas are consulting firms.
The top 10 recipients in last fiscal year are all offshore outsourcers, and they got 40,000 of the 85,000 visas.
Visas and outsourcing later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
Good afternoon, I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. The former chancellor of IPFW says in a federal lawsuit that the trustees of Purdue University forced him into retirement because of his gender. Michael Wartell was forced out at IPFW in 2011 under a Purdue policy that requires university executives to retire at age 65. Wartell's complaint filed on Monday says Purdue denied his request to remain chancellor, even though such requests by other chancellors had been honored in the past. The suit alleges former Purdue president France Cordova wished to hire more female administrators before her tenure ended in 2012. Wartell was replaced by 64-year-old Vicky Carwine. Purdue spokesman Chris Sigurdson declined to comment Tuesday on the filing. Cordova could not be reached for comment. Legislation regulating abortion-inducing drugs and the abortion clinics that provide them passed the Indiana House on Tuesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on a bill supporters say is aimed at strengthening patient safety and opponents call unnecessarily burdensome.
Abortion clinics that only provide the abortion drug RU486 will now be required to adhere to the same stricter standards as clinics that provide surgical abortions. Those requirements include room and door size mandates and surgical equipment standards. Only one Indiana location, a Planned Parenthood clinic in Lafayette, will be affected. The bill no longer requires an ultrasound before women receive the drug. Batesville Republican Cindy Zimke says she thinks the bill makes women give more consideration to the decision to have an abortion.
For a situation where a young girl may spend more time researching what dress she wants to wear to prom than terminating the life of an unborn child.
Hammond Democrat Linda Lawson says the General Assembly should spend its time talking about issues like birth control, education for young mothers, and maternity leave.
Why aren't we talking about that? Because many of the pro-life supporters don't extend their concern to the child after it's born.
Because the House made changes to the bill, the measure now goes back to the Senate. If the changes are accepted, the legislation heads to the governor's desk. Otherwise, the bill goes to conference committee for the House and Senate to work out the differences. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And Republican Governor Mike Pence isn't throwing much support behind a proposal that would require Indiana schools to have an employee carrying a loaded gun during school hours. The governor's office released a statement Tuesday saying Pence believes that decisions about school safety and security should be made by local schools. The bill, approved by an Indiana House committee, would require a new school protection officer. The officers could be police officers or school employees as long as they met training standards set by a statewide school safety board. The governor's statement says he supports local efforts to make schools as safe as possible, but does not directly state a position on requiring armed school employees. You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 here on WBOI Fort Wayne.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOI 89.1 FM. The time is 12:43, and if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or you can email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio this afternoon by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. James Elick, who's helping answer your questions about fibromyalgia. And we had a question come in right before we went to a break. Michael wanted to know, is there any physical rashes or pimples that will become evident on someone's body if they are diagnosed with fibromyalgia? Any physical symptoms that you could see?
No rashes are directly linked to fibromyalgia. In theory, with the stress or emotional, you can certainly see some hormonal changes causing acne. You can see a variety of the neurodermatoses, you know, eczema, people who scratch at themselves for nervous reasons. But there are no direct links between fibromyalgia and rashes.
And now we want to move on to the management of fibromyalgia. We've talked about how individuals can do some lifestyle changes, getting more sleep, getting more exercise. But what is the role of medications in controlling the pain and enhancing the quality of life of these patients? And where do you start?
When I discuss with my patients about managing fibromyalgia, we talk about that there are, I consider, two large categories for treating pain. You have immediately acting pain medications, which we call analgesics. Tylenol and nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories will work well in arthritis pain, but don't do much for fibromyalgia pain. So if you have an underlying arthritis disorder, they often are helpful. Tramadol has been somewhat helpful. Some people don't respond to it or don't like it. Opioids have been used over the years and have largely caused more problems than they've helped for most patients. So we really do try to stay away from the opioids. Two long-term studies have shown no benefit for fibromyalgia. And in migraine patients, obviously, they can be of detriment. So our focus has been what we call long-term drugs, and we call those adjunctive medications. And what they try to do is improve your neuroresistance to pain, if you will. And the two main categories there are dual-acting antidepressants. So antidepressants that work both on serotonin and norepinephrine seem to decrease a wide variety of types of pain, not just fibromyalgia. So traditionally, we've started with tricyclic antidepressants like amitriptyline, nortriptyline, at low doses of 10 to 50 milligrams, clearly reduce a wide variety of types of pain. But some people find some of the nuisance side effects difficult to tolerate. They may have a dry mouth, constipation. They may feel hungover in the morning. But they're very inexpensive, and they clearly work. And they tend to be a little better tolerated in younger patients than your older patients. The pure serotonin uptake inhibitors like Zoloft and Prozac and like that generally work great for mood disorders. They have done nothing for pain. And more recently, we've had two non-sedating dual-acting antidepressants have been indicated in fibromyalgia. One's Cymbalta and the other one's Savella. They're kind of mirror images of each other. They're not necessarily more effective than the tricyclics, but they do seem to be better tolerated. The other advantage that they have is at their full prescribing dose, they're also fairly decent antidepressants. So if you do have existing mood disorder, it helps with those. I find that I usually start with those because they have less issues with sedation and weight gain than the other class of medications that we use. And that would be the two broad-spectrum anti-seizure medications, generic Neurontin called gabapentin and Lyrica. Both work on the same receptor, Lyrica being the newer, more potent version of that same medicine. And they clearly reduce pain from fibromyalgia, diabetic neuropathy, headaches. At their higher doses, they do have a little bit of issues sometimes with sleepiness, dizziness, and even weight gain. But their efficacy has clearly been established. And the nice thing about them is they have a very clean profile, the fact that they don't interact much with other medications. So the side effects you see is what you see is what you get. And then, of course, we've had some other medicines have been around that are somewhat helpful, certain muscle relaxants and antispasmodics. But I refer to those as my bench players, not necessarily my starters.
And you will use often a combination of these medications?
Yes.
In treatment. And the Cymbalta and the Savella, they increase the level of serotonin in the central nervous system?
And norepinephrine.
And norepinephrine, which would be therapeutic in this regard. How does the Lyrica, where is the receptor you say that the Lyrica and the Neurontin block?
Well, the mechanism of actions for the antidepressants, we believe, are that they stimulate those inhibitory pathways we talked about earlier. Exactly. So that's where they work. The anti-seizure medications, we believe, work directly in neuronal tissue, and that's how they reduce seizures. They make nervous tissue less irritable. So they not only decrease your brain irritability for seizures, but they decrease the irritability of your pain fibers. And that's how we believe that they reduce pain from things like diabetic neuropathy and fibromyalgia. So they're making those local fibers less irritable.
But with medication, you really don't get a complete remission of the pain.
That is correct for the most part. Our really mild patients might do really well. Our more moderate to severe patients, you're looking just to reduce their pain enough that they can move on with their life.
Do any of these patients improve spontaneously, or is this a lifelong condition?
Most patients, it's chronic. The only long-term study I'm aware of was Fred Wolf looked at his study when he was studying fibromyalgia at 10 years, and he found basically patients were about the same. They were coping with it better, but they largely symptoms were unchanged over about 10 years. So some of our mild patients will spontaneously get better, particularly if there's some stress event that has gotten better. But most people, it's a chronic disorder.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. We're discussing fibromyalgia, and we just have about 10 minutes left in today's program. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We've talked a lot about how to treat fibromyalgia with medication, but Dr. Elick, is there something that mentally patients should be keeping in mind? Should they be, how do you take care of yourself mentally as well as physically when you're dealing with chronic pain throughout your life?
The cognitive treatment for chronic pain, not just fibromyalgia, has been around for a long time. So there's a variety of schools, but the most common one is called cognitive therapy behavior. It has an excellent track record and clearly has worked in a variety of types of pain. The problem that we get into is more of our insurance environment currently is insurance companies don't really want to pay. One, find somebody who's qualified to do that, and two, an insurance carrier will cover that. Because it's on the same order of counseling, if you will. And a lot of patients really don't have the time and effort to do that. Just like treating depression and anxiety with counseling requires a lot more effort than taking a pill. But it clearly works. Right now, it's just more of a practical point of finding somebody who's skilled in doing that and an insurance company willing to pay for it.
It's been pointed out that there are workbooks that people can do at home. So where there is a financial issue, once a patient has started on the cognitive behavioral therapy, they apparently can, if they are dedicated to this, do this at home in addition. And it's been stated that the goal is to allow them to accept the pain and move on. Is this generally the theory with the cognitive behavioral therapy, to objectify it, accept it, and move on with your life?
That is my understanding.
That also.
We need to take a quick break on Health 360, but we'll be back in just a few moments. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to write on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
After years of dealing with his son's addiction, which he wrote about in his bestseller, Beautiful Boy, David Sheff has written a new book called Clean, about the latest research into addiction and recovery. On the next Fresh Air, Sheff challenges some myths about addiction and recovery and talks about his own experiences as a parent. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in Northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more. At phpni.com.
Welcome back to Health 360. It's 12:54, and if you have a question or comment, we have just about 5 minutes left in today's program on fibromyalgia. You can email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm, or post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio this afternoon by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. James Elick.
I wanted to ask Dr. Elick, fibromyalgia does not appear to be curable, but what is the long-term outlook for patients who seek medical attention, who take the medications, who make the appropriate lifestyle changes, getting better sleep, getting better, more commitment to regular exercise? What is the long-term prognosis for these individuals?
For most patients, I find that they are able to cope with it and move on with their lives. They'll continue to have issues that fluctuate from time to time. In the SPOT surveys where, you know, they've estimated the incidence of the illness to be 2 to 4% of the population, they did find, too, that 2/3 of those patients were not seeking medical attention about their pain. So there's a lot of people out there just dealing with their pain. And so what the only long-term study that I'm aware of was Fred Wolf looked at 10 years over his experience with fibromyalgia and largely find patients were doing about the same over that period of time. They were coping with it better, but largely their symptoms were about the same. The meds, I think, have improved some, but not as much as what we've seen with, say, treatments for rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or some other conditions. And I think it's just a more complicated issue. It's not really lack of interest. It's just a more multifaceted problem in pain than it is in, perhaps even in the immune system. But overall, you know, if patients' emotional status is stable and their social status is stable, they usually deal with it reasonably well and move on.
And their longevity is the same as everyone else's? Is there any, and there's no chronic deterioration of the muscles or joints with this condition?
There is no known associated damage from that, and we're not aware of any direct impact on morbidity or mortality. Now, one could conjecture, you know, if they have coexisting depression, that may affect it or other issues, but not directly from the fibromyalgia itself. But of course, you know, we do know from other studies looking at just stress. So if the pain is causing you stress, that does seem to have some negative impact on that stuff. And that's why they've perhaps found, you know, that drinking 1 to 2 glasses of alcohol has been associated with longer survival. They think that reduces stress. Mm. So there may be some indirect contribution, but nothing substantial or direct that causes increased morbidity and mortality.
And the alcohol is interesting. There was a recent article that showed that low to moderate alcohol intake actually increases one of the neurotransmitters that is positive and facilitates the control of pain. It's also been pointed out, as Dr. Ehlich just said, that there's a lot of people out there who have pain and aren't seeking medical attention. And even though it's considered far more prevalent in women, a recent study showed that Only 1 out of 20 men with chronic pain is actually getting treated for it. And have you seen many men in your practice? And how often do men seek help for this?
We do see fewer men. Really depends on how you define it. Previous studies also looked a lot on tender points. And if you define the definition based on widespread pain and the other things we talked about, it is clear that tender points are much less prevalent on men. So if that's part of your diagnostic criteria by nature, they're going to have a lot fewer. But chronic pain is prevalent in men, but men are less likely to present to doctors with their symptoms.
And patients with chronic pain, where should they go first to seek medical help?
I would always start with your family physician and determine who would be best to see, you know, because they may ascertain you have a different problem. You may have neurologic issues and may be better off seeing a neurologist. If you've got severe mental health issues, you might be better off seeing a psychiatrist. Really depends on what your constellation of problems is getting to be. In the past, I used to refer to rheumatologists, but I think the latest guidelines suggest it really should be managed mostly by the primary care physicians.
Dr. Ehlich, thank you so much for coming on today and being a part of Health 360.
Thank you.
And just a quick programming note, in observance of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we're going to be airing an encore edition of Shadows of Innocence. It's a special program from Indiana Public Broadcasting about sexual assault among Indiana's youth. That's going to be featured from 8 to 9 p.m. on WBOI Presents this evening. You may have heard it earlier in the week on our news program on Midday Matters on Monday. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Mad Rothschild Studios at 89.1 in HD Channel 1, streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.